Welcome to another edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, it's your fault.
Yes, it is my fault.
It's your
and
fault.
I accept the blame entirely. I'd like to refer to everything that happens after this as the Elving Quester.
It does seem like, though, that whatever, if it's an Elving Quester or an Obama Quester or the Sequester, it seems like nobody in Washington seems to be concerned about how to fix this impending problem, which is coming up very soon. You know it's very important for Congress because they're off this week. And obviously, since the world is coming to an end, you know it's very, very important that they do something about it.
Okay, I'm not the guy to defend the Republicans all that often, but this was a scheduled recess. The Senate Democrats are on recess, too.
Oh, no, I'm not blaming Republicans.
The president was out playing golf with Tiger Woods. You know, I mean, none of these people is talking to any of these other people. They don't take this March 1st deadline seriously,
and I don't think the American people do either. It just seems like it's become a game of blame and not how do we fix this problem, if it indeed is a problem.
Okay, but it is a problem in this sense that, okay, March 1st, maybe not everything comes to an end. I've been calling it a brownout of the federal government because people are going to have to start preparing for how they would respond to the sequester should they take it seriously. And the Defense Department has said that they would lay off 700,000 of their civilian employees. Now, these are people who are waiting for a paycheck and aren't going to get it because they're furloughed. And they're talking about 22 days between March 1st and September 30th. That would be about 20% of the money they were expecting to make. That's going to make it tough on those families. These are not rich people. These are people doing ordinary civilian jobs for the Defense Department.
The reason the sequester is still happening is because we haven't reached the deadline yet. Just like with everything, with the fiscal cliff, with the debt ceiling limit, all that stuff, it's a crisis that's supposed to be really monumental in scope, and yet ultimately nobody seems to be concerned about it until the last second. That's why I'm making the point that Congress is out this week. If this was the end of the world, if this was Henny Penny, why is Congress out the week before this March 1st deadline?
That's absolutely right. I mean, they should be here and they should be desperately trying to come up with some sort of a solution. But in fact, as you said earlier, it doesn't appear that the American public is holding its breath over this either. They were over the fiscal cliff, which, by the way, included this sequester at one point, and then they added a couple of months back on the 1st of January. So that's why we're coming down to the 1st of March. And, you know, at this point, they've cried wolf so many times.
Yes.
The American people's out there going, oh, they're just going to come up with something, and they're going to call it something else, and they're going to kick the can down the road and, you know, pass the potato chips. I'm not really interested.
One thing that's clear is that if the American people are paying attention to this upcoming impending crisis, the polls seem to indicate that the American people are behind President Obama. He has very high approval numbers, whereas the Republicans in Congress seem to have very low approval ratings. And I think President Obama, completely aware of this, is taking his argument to the public.
So now Republicans in Congress face a simple choice. Are they willing to compromise to protect vital investments in education and health care and national security and all the jobs that depend on them? Or would they rather put hundreds of thousands of jobs and our entire economy at risk just to protect a few special interest tax loopholes that benefit only the wealthiest Americans and biggest corporations? That's the choice.
Oh, yes. Such a simple choice.
That's a fair description of the argument. And you know something? The Republicans will say, look, we've been losing and giving up and compromising. This is what the Republican argument is. We accepted the higher taxes, the taxes.
Like $600 billion in greater revenue.
And we have not seen the corresponding cut in spending. So they're saying, look, we've met with the president. We've gotten our heads handed to us each time. This time, the compromise is over until we see what the president has to offer.
Well, they're expecting the president to put forward cuts to the budget that they then will not be held responsible for, even though they are the ones demanding that there be cuts to the budget. Right. And the president is saying, I'll take a couple of bucks of spending cuts for every dollar of tax revenue, but we have to do it on both sides. And there appears to be polling support for the president's position, as you suggest. Most people say, yeah, balanced approach. Let's get some revenue, especially if it doesn't come from me. And let's also get some spending cuts. And they also agree that most of the money that reduces the deficit ought to come from spending cuts, even if that includes defense, even if it includes some programs that they might value. They think we should get more money from spending cuts than from revenues, but they think there should be both.
We have another podcast next week, which will be just prior to the deadline. What's your gut tell you about where we're going to be a week from now?
I don't think we'll have a deal. There might be some last-minute offers as a means to blaming the other side. In other words, each side will come up with something that looks pretty good from their standpoint and say, why don't you guys just sign on to that? No compromise. And of course, neither side will sign on without any sort of a compromise deal. So both sides will have rejected the other side's proposal, and we will begin the sequester on March 1st.
You don't think somebody's going to come up with, say, oh, look, let's just have a little temporary solution here. Let's punt it another 6 months down the road.
No, I don't, because I think that there is a general agreement that we are coming to a moment when enough of these elements and factors will be in conjunction. You know, it's a little bit like getting the stars to align, so that you will have on March 27th, the end of the current funding, a resolution that's keeping the federal government open. Now, that's not a brownout. That's a blackout. That's where you really do stop delivering the mail and you really do send people home from work. That, I think, would be upsetting to the American people. So if they essentially conflate this one deadline that has to do with the sequester, and they bring that together with the government shutdown deadline, then I think the American people are really going to get interested. And when they start bringing pressure to bear, then I think there will be a deal.
What about a deal for Chuck Hagel? We saw last week that the Senate was unable to end debate in the non-filibuster filibuster. The Senate vote was 58 to 40, but it was really 59 to 41.
Yeah, because
Harry Reid switched.
He has to do that so that he can bring it back for another vote.
So they were only one vote short, but now over the weekend we saw that Lindsey Graham and John McCain, two big opponents, strong opponents of Chuck Hagel's nomination to be Secretary of Defense, said, you know what, we're no longer going to hold up this nomination.
And why did they do that?
Well, I think they wanted to get their little ounce of flesh, and they got their ounce of flesh. They made him squirm, and they did make him squirm. They probably pushed Mike Johanns out of the Senate, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, too. But obviously, look, they're not going to get all the answers they want. To hold up Chuck Hagel's nomination because of Benghazi seems a little...
Well, Chuck Hagel had nothing to do with it.
Of course. But I think a lot of it is personal. Getting back at Chuck Hagel's, you know, maverickness... Maverickity?
Well, he didn't support John McCain for president in 2008, and he didn't support the surge in Iraq.
President Bush's war effort, right. He voted for it in the beginning. He was among the most vociferous critics of Bush's policy of either party, and of course he was ostensibly a Republican at the time, and Republicans denounced that. So it was interesting that Deb Fischer, a fellow Republican from Nebraska, also voted to hold up that nomination last week, but the vote is going to come again on February 26th. It looked like Hagel won't get bar mitzvahed, but he will get confirmed. And I
just wanted to make sure there wouldn't be one week this year that you didn't use that joke.
No, it's not going to happen. But I think it'll be probably the highest, aside from John Tower, whose nomination was defeated, I think probably more no votes on this nomination than any other defense secretary in history.
Can Chuck Hagel serve effectively as defense secretary after having been put through this ringer over the last 2 months? I put it to you, Ken Rudin.
I don't think so. I think that the bad feelings that John McCain and Lindsey Graham will continue to have even after the confirmation will just go on throughout his term as Secretary of Defense. And I don't see that relationship healing anytime soon.
I think also some of the Republicans, of course, have smelled a rat in this entire nomination because they saw Barack Obama choosing a Republican to be the Secretary of Defense during a period of time during which the Department of Defense will be shrunk, will get smaller, will get less money. And they think that the president thinks that the Republican Party will bear some of that responsibility if there's a Chuck Hagel in the top job.
Oh, I don't think so at all, because just like with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, this was still Barack Obama's policy. This is a Barack Obama's presidency. He doesn't delegate authority to a Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State. This is a top-up policy. I think any kind of blame on Chuck Hagel or John Kerry, for that matter, for kind of policies, these are Obama policies we're talking about.
And let's move into the realm of electoral politics. I know you go here kind of reluctantly, Ken.
I do.
But if we could talk a little bit about campaigns and votes that are coming up. Already the 2014 Senate races are getting interesting, and we're still very early in 2013.
Well, you have this week the fifth senator to announce that he will not run for re-election in 2014, but this was a huge surprise. Mike Johanns of Nebraska, 62 years old.
Only one term.
First term and very popular. Obviously, he had no difficulty winning another term.
Senator for life.
He said he wanted to spend more time with General Petraeus' family, and I understand that. But I think what it really amounts to, I mean, he said he's been on the ballot so many times over the past couple of years.
And he has, after all.
He has.
He was governor a couple of terms
right,
and so on.
Right,
so he has been in public life for a long time.
And he was Secretary of Agriculture in the Bush presidency.
Which was a lot of fun. You can imagine. You can imagine the riot that it would be to be ag secretary.
Laugh riot. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think he's also defending a Chuck Hagel among his Republican colleagues in the Senate, and they despise Chuck Hagel. And I think, wait a second, this is not working. Remember, Mike Johanns was among the Gang of Eight who tried to come up with a compromise on deficit reduction, and that went nowhere. I think most everything he was trying to accomplish has gone nowhere. And he said, what's the point?
All right. So you're suggesting to me, Ken, I'm hearing you correctly,
what?
That there's something of a war going on in the Republican Party. All right. I'm parodying some of our friends in cable television. There is a rising, if you will, theme or trope in the cable news coverage of a war in the Republican Party, that there is a division going on between Republicans when it comes to whether it's Chuck Hagel or whether it comes to cutting the budget or on any range of issues. We're seeing, for example, in Kentucky, a fellow by the name of Matt Brevin, whom I had never heard of until a few weeks ago. And he is wealthy, and he is also extremely conservative and doesn't think that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, is conservative enough.
And I think that's one of the reasons why Mitch McConnell, to his credit, look, he's a very smart guy, very canny guy. He doesn't win by huge margins in Kentucky, like 53-52%, but he still knows how to play the game. He got Rand Paul's campaign manager to run his campaign in 2014, very aware of what possible opposition from the conservative wing, the Tea Party wing of the party.
And Mitch McConnell is also covering his bets for November of 2014 by launching a preemptive strike on a potential Democratic challenger. Now, she had already been out there as a name, Ashley Judd, the actress who is from Kentucky. She went to the University of Kentucky. She does have Kentucky roots.
Absolutely.
That's not an illegitimate claim on her part. But she also has spent a lot of time in Tennessee, and she also has said a lot of things about considering Tennessee her home.
Wasn't she a Tennessee delegate to the 2012 Democratic Convention?
Which would be one of those ways she looks like she's from Tennessee. But anyway, the ad that was originally produced against her came from Karl Rove's independent group. Now, Mitch McConnell himself has an ad up against the prospective candidate, and it starts out by showing President Obama.
All right, and I'm going to start with this young lady right here in the sort of the pink, white blouse. Yeah, right there. All right, and wait till the microphone comes up. Introduce yourself.
From the volunteer state, I proudly stand to nominate.
Whoa.
Tennessee, the home of former Vice President Al Gore.
Okay, so here we are at the 2012 convention, and we are having a little video evidence of how she was a Tennessee delegate at that convention, and now she wants to run for the Senate from Kentucky. Ouch.
Yeah, I just wonder, and I think we've said this before in previous podcasts, I wonder if the Republican and the independent group's attacks on Ashley Judd will be so effective that they'll just drive her out of the race and they won't have, you know, that option of running against her. Because I still think that anybody who's a pro-Obama Democrat with liberal positions to run in Kentucky in 2014 is not the way to beat Mitch McConnell.
I would think, in fact, that they would welcome her candidacy.
The Republicans.
Yes, because she would probably be formidable for the nomination. And then there she is, and she fulfills every fantasy of a target you could imagine. And Mitch McConnell would probably be safe. But they're taking an opposite tack, and after all, they do it for a living. We've already talked a little bit about the Nebraska contest, where there'll be probably multiple Republican candidates.
Unless Dave Heineman preempts the field, right?
And is Dave Heineman safe from any kind of a Tea Party challenge?
Well, he's very conservative. He's very, very popular. He's also term limited. They wanted him to run for the seat in 2012, but he didn't want to give up the governorship. And so maybe in 2014, he does run for the Senate, but we'll wait and see on that.
All right. Nebraska, pretty much a red state. New Jersey, pretty much a blue state.
Yeah, I can't think, other than Geraldo Rivera, and that's not a serious candidacy, I can't think of a single Republican or even a married Republican who could possibly run against the winner of the Democratic primary now that Frank Lautenberg, 89 years and counting, has decided not to run again.
I think it's great that Frank is still counting, and I think also that we have to handicap that Democratic field. Do you like Cory Booker?
I do. I am one of his 1.3 million tweet followers. I don't know why that's a big deal. Everybody keeps referring to the number of people who follow him on Twitter, and I'm not sure how that translates into votes. But he's a very popular, charismatic guy. He did alienate a lot of Lautenberg people by expressing his desire to come to the Senate.
Over-eager.
Well, before Lautenberg announced his retirement. And
The old guy out the door.
And Frank Pallone, who's been a congressman since 1988 from the Jersey Shore, wants to be senator badly. He's waited his turn. He's been around since 1988. But Cory Booker, African-American, mayor of Newark.
He's a fantastic media character.
He is.
Absolutely fantastic media character, saving people from burning buildings and, you know, dogs crossing the street. And he's just completely dominated the early media in this campaign. But does Frank Pallone have enough purchase on the actual machinery of the New Jersey Democratic Party that he could pull a surprise here? In fact, is there a third party?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair question. I think Lautenberg has spent a lot of time basically either doing Pallone's work or the Republicans' work if Cory Booker is the nominee, because he has talked about how Cory Booker has not done the job in Newark. He's not finished the job. He's been too distracted. And it's not exactly what you want to hear if Cory Booker is the nominee. But right now, if I had to guess, in the June 2014 primary, I think Cory Booker will be the nominee, of course. There are no Republicans out there talking about running against him.
Let's turn to the House. In 2013, we've got a couple of races, so don't even have to wait until next year. Of course, Jesse Jackson Jr. pled guilty this week to charges of having defrauded his own campaign for $750,000, much of it in, you know, personal items like a gold-plated Rolex and a Michael Jackson.
A $43,000 Rolex, exactly. Michael Jackson memorabilia.
Elk heads that looked like Michael Jackson.
Right.
Really kind of tawdry stuff. And he's looking at the possibility. I don't know how much time he'll actually get, if he'll get any at all.
But he's going to jail.
He's going to jail. And, I mean, 47 to 57 months is the range recommended by the prosecutors. Ouch.
I mean, everybody's talking about the tragedy for Jesse Jackson Jr. and his family, his wife, Sandy,
his former father.
Right, but Sandy Jackson will also probably go to prison for filing false tax returns. Anyway, there's going to be a special election.
Just coming up next week, on Tuesday.
On Tuesday, February 26th. Robin Kelly. Robin Kelly, a former state rep, African-American woman, looks like a clear choice.
She's really consolidated a lot of the vote recently. Her biggest opponent really quit the race and endorsed Robin Kelly.
All the fears that the African-American community had about a white candidate winning an overwhelmingly African-American district, it's probably not going to happen. Robin Kelly will win. Of course, it's a primary on Tuesday. The general election is in April, but it's tantamount to victory.
Tantamount. I love that word, tantamount. All right, so not much suspense maybe in Chicago next week, but 3 weeks after that, there will be a highly suspenseful primary in the Republican Party in South Carolina, where we might be seeing the comeback, or certainly seeing the comeback attempt, of former Governor Mark Sanford. Here's his first ad in the campaign.
Washington's math doesn't add up. And so for years, while many have talked, I've fought to do something about it. I've cut spending, reduced debt, and made government more accountable. More recently, I've experienced how none of us go through life without mistakes. But in their wake, we can learn a lot about grace, a God of second chances, and be the better for it. In that light, I humbly step forward and ask for your help in changing Washington.
Can we just step back and just say, oh my. More recently, I've experienced how none of us go through life without mistakes.
Yeah, but enough about you, Ron Elving. His mistakes are well documented when he was governor of South Carolina, but he seems to be getting a bit of forgiveness from very strong conservatives, both nationally and in South Carolina. Look, as a congressman, he was a very effective conservative advocate. He was conservative advocate when he was governor. Ron Elving is making a face.
I'm sorry, but the entire country watched this guy, you know, burn down on his lack of personal integrity. His wife, his former wife, the mother of his children, has been very visible in the state and clearly is not supporting him for this seat.
And she's beloved.
And she is beloved in the state. I mean, maybe he's going to make a comeback here because of the rest of the field being a little bit lackluster and because the district is so Republican. But by the way, we do have the potential for an interesting matchup in the general election for this particular seat.
Okay, but before you go there, remember, he still could very well finish first in the primary, but then he has a runoff, and we'll see if anybody but Sanford wing of the Republican Party manages to attract a majority of the votes in the runoff. Now, of course, you think of this as a solidly Republican district, but Stephen Colbert's sister, Elizabeth Colbert Bush, not Colbert Bush, but Colbert Bush, is going to be the Democratic nominee in the general election. But, you know, Democrats have...
How do we know she's going to be the Democratic nominee? Because nobody else wants to be a sacrificial lamb?
Well, except for the fact, no, I think it will be a sacrificial lamb. But it's worth noting that in 2008, when the Republican incumbent of this district was a guy named Henry Brown, the Democrat got 48% of the vote in that district. So stranger things have happened. Democrats could make a showing.
It was before redistricting.
Yes.
And so we expect that it will be Colbert Bush or Colbert Bush or whomever you want to call her. And she is making a valiant attempt here. It would shock me, unless, of course, Mark Sanford turns out to be surprisingly weak in the general runoff, if she could make a real contest of this.
I suspect not.
All right. And while we're talking about Mark Sanford and his past improprieties, a sad story, really, emerged this week about Pete Domenici, the former senator from New Mexico, having had a love child, I believe is the euphemism we used to use in that era, 30-some years ago, with the daughter of another senator at the time, Paul Laxalt from Nevada, Michelle Laxalt, and she has raised that son in secrecy, never revealing the fatherhood. And Pete Domenici and she both say that that was her decision.
This is a very sad story. I don't even know what to make of it, especially when you think of Pete Domenici. Remember, he was known as St. Pete.
Oh, he's a huge family man. Yeah. I mean, he's got
eight children.
And he's been with his wife his whole life.
But the thought of Paul Laxalt's daughter and Pete Domenici, you know, there's a city in New Mexico called Truth or Consequences. There has to be some moral something.
There's what we call a moral failing in here somewhere. Yeah. And it is a sad story now, of course, partly because it's coming out in this manner.
He's 80 years old.
It's obviously an embarrassment to both families. And, of course, there is a son, Adam Laxalt, who is practicing attorney in Nevada and who would have preferred that his privacy be respected in this regard. But interestingly, Michelle Laxalt felt she needed to make a statement and needed to go public with this because she was under pressure from some unnamed...
Apparently somebody was going to reveal this story, right?
...person,
right.
Whether that's a black male artist or some news organization or some blog or whomever, she did not specify, but she felt forced to bring this to the public.
Another bizarre story I noticed this week was Joe Biden, who's, of course, heading up the administration's effort to combat guns and gun violence.
Yes.
He has a recommended solution, apparently.
Yes. Let's hear.
If you want to protect yourself, get a double-barrel shotgun, have the shells, a 12-gauge shotgun, and I promise you, as I told my wife, we live in an area that's wooded and somewhat secluded. I said, Jill, if there's ever a problem, just walk out on the balcony here or walk out, put that double barrel shotgun and fire two blasts outside the house. I promise you, who's ever coming in is not going to. You don't need an AR-15. It's harder to aim. It's harder to use. And in fact, you don't need 30 rounds to protect yourself. Buy a shotgun.
I know that the area they're living in, it's where the vice president's residency is. And I think just the thought of Jill Biden standing out there with a shotgun.
On their balcony.
Off on Massachusetts Avenue.
While I'm driving by on
exactly.
My way home.
I think all you have to do is fire two shots and then the guys know that the gun is empty.
I had no idea that's what he meant by gun control.
Look, all I can say is that if he runs in 2016, I want a man of that caliber in the White House.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
Sure is. You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm appalled, Ron Ill.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Thank goodness. Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.